Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Well, the movie Flyboy has opened up in the States this week, and once again, the team from Double Negative did an outstanding job with visual effects work in the film. The film is set in the World War I time period and centers a lot around air-to-air dogfights. And for that, Double Negative pulled out all the stops to do these really complex air-to-air combat scenes, you know, having to create an entire 360-degree environment in which to do the dogfight, as well as blending some live action with CGI elements. And they also did some really nice matte painting work as well, just more traditional matte painting and so forth, scenes such as the Gare du Nord in Paris. So for this week's podcast, we're going to break it up into two parts, and first with a look at the 3D compositing realm, and then dive into a little bit of the 2D compositing as well. So for 3D part, Mike Seymour is going to be talking with Alex Wutka, who's the CGI supervisor at Double Negative for the film. So let's go ahead and join that conversation now.
Yeah, thanks, John. And thanks for joining us, Alex.
My pleasure.
So are you guys trying to break some land speed record for doing visual effect shots or what?
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah. Let me get over that hump straight away, because I must have been misinformed, because somebody told me that you guys did close to 700 or 800 shots in an astonishingly short amount of time. What's the story?
Yeah, that's right.
And how many people did you have on the team?
We totaled towards the end around 140 artists.
Wow.
Working pretty much full-time, around the clock.
So to pull that off, you need systems in place. I mean, you so need to have systems in place before you even get going, don't you? Because there's really no time to get anything in place once you start running.
No, that's right. I mean, there's a lot of kind of work put up front to try and, you know, organise our pipeline to suit the picture. So there was a lot of work done on pipelining and development of tools that would enable us to turn shots around pretty rapidly once we got them in the door.
Now, for those people that haven't seen the film, maybe they've seen the trailer or not, just give me the basic rundown of the premise of the film.
Okay, it effectively concerns the plight of it's mainly one man who leaves the States to fight in the First World War, and it becomes a pilot. So he joins a small band of pilots who are all American, and they fly for the French Air Force, and it follows their adventures, you know, covering various battles from being fledgling pilots all the way through to, you know, becoming quite accomplished in combat. And there's a bit of a love story in there as well. So there's a whole mixed bag, but primarily we're concerned with the airborne battles.
Yeah, as the name would indicate, there's a lot of flying sequences and a lot of very adventurous flying sequences at that.
That's right. Yeah, we were kind of aiming to do something that hadn't really been seen before. It's kind of a little bit beyond films like sort of Top Gun, which are concerned with supersonic flight and things happen ever so quickly, and there's a lot of sort of jump cuts. This was more to do with the way that pilots would actually fly in the First World War, which was a relatively kind of slow speed, but I mean that enabled us to capture a lot more action, and also the way we moved the camera around a little bit was a bit more constrained to the speed that they'd be flying. So we're seeing a lot more kind of traditional dogfighting manoeuvres and things like that, which obviously presents a challenge.
Yeah, I'll come to that in a second, and especially your part, because you were primarily focused on the environments that they were flying in, is that correct?
That's right, yes.
But just before we do that, I just have to ask you about the motion capturing of flight. That just sounds... Mm-hmm. Can you explain that for everyone that maybe hasn't heard?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, whereas with kind of traditional, say, optical motion capture, you know, you're constrained within a small stage and, you know, you're capturing the action that's happening within that kind of constrained field of view. With what we were doing, we wanted to actually go up with a plane and capture its movement and everything that entails. So the planes would go through a range of different motions, from barrel rolls to dives and things like that. We wanted to capture, you know, all the nuances of that flight. So, you know, not just kind of the forward motion or whatever it may be, but also the real subtleties of the way that the plane would kind of vibrate in the air and the way that it would kind of go into a stall and things like that. So essentially what we did is we got hold of a unit called an IMU unit, which is an inertial motion unit. Now, what that is, it's essentially a box with some gyroscopes and an accelerometer. And that data is essentially, it's capturing all the kind of details of the rolls and the way that the plane moves in the air. And once we've got that data, we can essentially, kind of transpose it onto our CG models.
So I guess if you're sampling, I think that, if I'm right, that unit was sampling at about, 128 frames a second, or 128 samples per second? Does that sound about right?
That's right, yes.
So yeah. Was there a lot of data cleanup to get that to be an accurate non-jittery motion? Or, I mean, how...
Oh, yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So it's the kind of the same as with, say, traditional motion capture. There's always a lot of high-frequency noise, which you need to filter out, things like that. But the approach we took, essentially, was because we wanted to be steering our own animation and driving the motion of the plane, the gross motion of the planes ourselves, we derived a tool which would extract, sort of the mid to high frequency noise from the flight characteristics of a plane as it's going through a dive, for instance, and map it back onto our CG animation. So we're able to kind of use, we could animate something very quickly and apply, based on that motion, apply real world flight characteristics to the plane from our derived motion capture.
I mean, that's just so important, isn't it? Because that sense of a plane drifting relative to another one and breaking, unnatural acceleration can really throw you out of a film. It can really take you out of any kind of believability, especially, as you say, because you weren't jump cutting and being quite so aggressive. But I guess the downside of being a bit slower was everyone got to see your environments very well.
Yes.
I guess that's the upside and the downside. Downside only being that you couldn't hide everything through a huge amount of motion blur.
No, that's right. I mean, a lot of the times, the camera is actually traveling with the plane as it's kind of spinning through the environment. So, and at times we're flying sort of relatively low level. So there's a lot of time to be able to soak up, the environments that the planes are traveling through.
So, in a shot, how sort of far, did you ever sort of think about it, how far the plane is actually travelling in sort of a longer shot? I mean, how much ground are you having to...
Yeah, I mean, we were kind of operating within real-world units and real-world speeds. The planes would be travelling, at times around sort of 60, 70 miles an hour, which is pretty fast for those kind of planes. Obviously we juiced it a little bit to add a bit more drama. Tops maybe sort of around 90 to 100 miles an hour. Over a shot that might last kind of over, I don't know, sort of over sort of 400 frames, you can imagine that's quite a distance to travel. So the approach that we took really was to create a bunch of battle arenas. And the distances that you could actually travel within that one arena would potentially be up to kind of like 15 kilometers.
So
it's quite a distance.
So effectively you're building a virtual environment that's, say, 15 kilometers of valid space. And so the obvious problem there is just data swamping. You're going to be absolutely swamped by that amount of data if you've got to travel through that much physical space. How did you deal with data management and actually, model complexity on that sort of size?
Okay, so basically you're absolutely right. That's a huge amount of data, and especially when you're thinking about the resolutions that you need to be kind of holding things up to. So one of the approaches we took specifically for the terrain that you'd be seeing underneath the plane was we got a company called Aerofilms to go out and shoot us a whole bunch of kind of top-down orthographic plates of landscape covering quite a distance around sort of 15 kilometers. Now each of those, you would capture it in tiles, and each of those tiles was absolutely enormous. So you can imagine when you sort of placed all these tiles together how much data you'd end up with. And even for a modern renderer like RenderMan, that's still a huge task to be able to hold fit all that into memory as it's rendering it. So one tool we came up with was something called Tepto, which would essentially keep everything in tiles, but only load dynamically the tiles that were actually visible within the camera's frustum at a given time. So in that respect, we could kind of streamline what was fed into the renderer and only give it what it was needed at the specific time. We also cascaded other bits of data into that kind of huge monolithic database that would include the descriptions of hedgerows, you know, where clusters of trees were, so that we could actually kind of grow procedurally bits of vegetation and little bits and pieces like that into the renderer when and as they were needed.
So let me ask you firstly, the capturing by AeroFilms, was that captured digitally or on film, and was there did you capture a high dynamic range, or how did that work?
Yeah, I believe that it was captured on film, and we pulled kind of EXR data out of that, so we kind of, you know, bounced down all the high dynamic range into a bunch of each tile would take up a single EXR image, which would contain all the range that we needed. So effectively what we could do as well would be to actually relight the terrain to suit the kind of time of day that we'd be flying through as well. We could do that because we had the complete range available to us within each style.
And you mentioned hedges and trees and stuff. Am I right in thinking that you used some kind of volumetric sprites? Is that right?
That's right, yeah. We came up with a tool called Sprouts, which was essentially, you know, we'd create a library of different kind of trees and hedgerows and vegetation and things like that. And we could bake that down into a voxel structure, which kind of means we could, you know, we could light it fairly efficiently and easily. But more to the point, we could actually create kind of quite huge amounts of these trees and tumuluses and forests and things like that.
Yeah.
And lay them out fairly efficiently.
Now, Alex, I'm a bit of an old 2D guy, so maybe you could explain it to me. But I figured the whole point of sprites is they're 2D of live action or of generated textures. What's a volumetric sprite?
Essentially, if you think of the 2D sprite as just being an image mapped onto a flat plane, that's going to work, you know, say if you're on a nodal pan or if you're kind of pushing in towards it. But obviously, because we're kind of looking at this stuff from the air and we're traveling from quite an extreme distance away from the object, right over the top of it and then past it, there's quite a bit of parallax involved in that. And one of the things that the baked-in textures on the Tepto terrain wouldn't give us would be that, you know, evident parallax.
Right.
And, you know, at times we were seeing parallax even from quite a height up, you know, from a, say, a sort of couple of thousand feet, you'd still see visible parallax between the tops of trees and the ground. And what the volumetric solution would give us would have that actual kind of sense of parallax, you know, right in there in the model. So as you're flying past it, you're getting a little change of perspective on the trees and their relation to the ground.
So was that sprite, therefore, effectively a cube rather than a flat 2D plane, or was
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly, yeah. So it becomes camera dependent, you know, and whatever you're looking at will change depending on the camera angle.
Because, in fact, you need this to be quite efficient, because we're talking not about a couple of trees here, we're talking about a forest.
We are, yeah, and we're actually talking about, you know, not just one forest, but there may be kind of a whole kind of system of different forests interconnecting and right across the terrain all the way up to the horizon. There's a huge amount of data.
Now, ironically, if we go to what Howard Hughes discovered in The Aviator, it's that clouds really help sell aerial shots. Now, famously in that film by Martin Scorsese, they wasted a lot of time waiting for clouds. How did you solve your clouds, and did you find it anchored the planes as well?
Not just kind of one or two hero plants, but pretty much the whole arena had to be completely populated with these 3D clouds.
And judging from the shots, there's self-shadowing and a whole lot of lighting issues there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, when you're right up close to a cloud, then there's an amazing range of subtleties that describe it and that sell it as a real kind of volume. So one of the issues that we faced was generally with the lighting of them, because they can go very white very quickly, and you can get a lot of white out, especially in a large volume. So we came up with several different tools to be able to. It was actually an extension of the volumetric stuff that we'd done on Batman for the steam geysers.
So it was a voxel renderer?
It was indeed a voxel renderer. It's called DNB. Which stands for double negative renderer B, which is a little bit unimaginative. There you go. And it's a full 3D volumetric solution. And we came up with certain tools which enable us, first of all, to have self-shadowing within the cloud, but also to be able to scatter the light that's coming into the cloud using a technique which is known as multiple forward scattering. Which would actually kind of prismatically disperse the light within the volume of the cloud, scatter it around, and then have it come out kind of on the underside, for example, with a slightly different spectral hue, which is quite a subtle effect, but it goes quite a long way to sell the appearance of a realistic cloud.
Conceptually, it's almost like a subsurface scattering, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's from the same kind of family of equations. And maths is there, and the way that we did it was, obviously it can be quite an expensive process, but we came up with a way of storing this scattering into a bunch of maps, which are kind of like, you know, sort of 3D maps almost, that we could then, you know, have the data baked in there and at render time just be doing texture lookups. So it was pretty quick in that respect.
Wow, that's amazing. And now you mentioned the whites could obviously, you know, flatline to on the screen. The thing we haven't touched on is a lot of this original photography in the film was done on Genesis and effectively HD. So presumably the effects team got 444 Panalog files, 10-bit?
That's right. We had to kind of... this is obviously an area that our 2D guys probably know a bit more about, in terms of the origination and stuff like that. But, everything would come through in that fashion, and then we'd have it converted over to EXR. So, you know, our whole pipeline was completely floating point, right from the renders through to the origination and then through the composite and then out the other end, it would all be completely EXR.
So you've got your environments that are, let's say, for argument's sake, a 12 or 15 kilometre round... battle, what do you call it?
A battle arena,
thank you. And in that, we've got dynamic allocation of texturing based on camera position, as well as voxel rendering of clouds, and also the volumetric sprites. I guess the only other bit of the equation is, what were you rendering those at, given that it was the rest of the production effectively was dealing with 1920 by 1080? Were you rendering like 4K or just 2K, or what were you doing?
Well, pretty much we were kind of doing the whole thing at 2K. I mean, there are certain shots where obviously there's a lot of detail in certain areas. So that, you know, for certain hero shots, we'd be going out of 4K for some of the terrain and things like that. But generally, it was mainly 2K.
I guess I'm just curious that, given that you were producing that complexity and you had the 4 months of post schedule, were your render times the biggest issue, or did you have that solved through creative R&D, as you described before?
Yeah, I mean, the whole rendering side of things was, obviously, it wasn't too bad. We managed to get, as you say, get quite a good handle on it up front via R&D, and in fact, that was always something that loomed large in our minds, because obviously we knew we could accomplish the work. It was more a question of throughput, and, you know, how can you actually output that many shots in the time allocated? So, you know, we went through a lot of R&D to come up with solutions for that, and by and by, we managed to kind of get our rendering times down. Pretty, you know, it's a pretty kind of absorbable limit. We could turn a shot around pretty much in an afternoon by the end of it, and that was through judicious use of caching we're dealing with really is just a lookup, almost like a 2D lookup, but done from a 3D standpoint.
I mean, just to quantify that for people, if they haven't done the maths in their head, if we just use round numbers for a second, if you've got, say, 800 shots to get out in 4 months, just by simple maths, you're trying to get out, you know, a couple of hundred a month. And and that's assuming that you had no uptime. And then add to that the fact that you, well, let's just say you decided to sit around and talk about any shot for 30 minutes. If you had to get through 50 a week, that'd be like, you know, 12 and a half hours. Like it's basically 25 hours, sorry. That would be like about 2.5 days of just discussing the final shots per week, which only leave you half a week to actually do the next round of shots. So it's pretty astounding actually delivering that kind of rate of shots, no matter what the production is.
No, absolutely, yeah. And, challenge.
And then just revising them, presumably. I mean, I'm sure there were revisions, as there always are.
Of course, yeah.
So tell me this, what about the use of matte paintings? Because anyone with their head screwed on would be going, well, why couldn't you just put a couple of matte paintings in the background and call it quits? You did use some matte paintings, right?
We did, absolutely. So obviously when you think about kind of the kind of height that we're shooting these planes at, you're obviously going to go and see off into the horizon, effectively off into infinity. So, you know, there's the ground immediately below us was all procedurally generated. And then what we did was essentially we created a kind of like a concave psych, which would travel along the ground from quite a distance out to meet the sky and create that horizon. Now, that was all a matte painting. Although the way that it worked was essentially we did the form of a cylindrical projection out from the center of the universe, which was where all of the action takes place, out to the horizon. And that was a projected matte painting. And then similarly with the actual sky dome, that was essentially another matte painting. But it was derived from actually real-world skies that were shot by Peter Chang, the visual effects supervisor in a helicopter, and then tiled together using a proprietary tiling system that we have called STIG. And that generated an absolutely huge matte painting that I think it was in the region of 12K across. And that would hold for the, you know, for the distant horizon. So yeah, there was a fair amount of matte painting involved. Although it was quite a complex matte painting in that it had to kind of see pretty seamlessly from, you know, our Tecto database, the terrain database that we had, right off into the horizon. And that was all done through projection.
But we maybe am getting the impression to people that there's only, you know, a bunch of European fields with a few trees, but in fact you needed to span visual effects that happened everywhere from Nebraska to New York to Paris.
That's right, yeah, of course. We did quite a lot of matte painting actually for other shots. There was a huge amount of matte painting, in fact, for certain shots that would allow it. But I mean, generally it was that was handled entirely by our matte painting department and the compositing.
And you said it was an OpenEXR pipe, so most of this material was ending up, I presume, in Shake for final compositing?
That's right, yeah, we use Shake pretty much exclusively.
Were you doing a multi-pass rendering, or was it that you were trying to aim to get it nailed in 3D and then...
Yeah, I mean, that's quite an interesting thing, actually, because obviously when you're talking about flexibility, you want to be able to retain that flexibility all the way through to the comp. So what we output in 3D... would essentially be a bunch of secondary outputs. It was really, when we're talking about the planes, for instance, we were outputting, I can't remember what the exact kind of upper number was on the amount of secondaries, because it would vary, obviously, depending on the shot. But for a hero shot, we would output, you know, things like diffuse, specular, occlusion, reflection occlusion, with all manner of passes that could then be passed on to 2D. And then within Shake, we had a custom node that would kind of literally just, it would know what to expect, and it would be able to pull in all the various passes that would comprise a plane, for example, and pretty much just composite them within this one node. And then within the node, you'd expose certain parameters that would allow you to change the look of the plane after the render.
It must have been also, because there's quite a lot of smoke as well. It wasn't just the planes and the clouds. There's one great shot where I may be completely wrong in saying this, but it looks like the Red Baron gets hit. Is that... looked like way too much fun for me, but Now, that required its own smoke generation in addition to everything else you've described.
Absolutely, yeah. And that was actually another thing that we pushed through our same volumetric pipeline with DNB. So that was all the smoke was generated using fluid dynamics. That's then sort of baked out into the format that we use called GTO. And then that's in turn fed through our custom volumetric renderer. And obviously the good thing about that renderer is that it is blindingly fast and it's massively optimized. So we could do those kind of smoke effects pretty rapidly.
And there's also a, I want to call it a blimp, but I think its correct name is a,
the Zeppelin.
Zeppelin, thank you.
Yes.
Did that pose any interesting problems for you in terms of lighting?
Yes, it did. Obviously, it's something that we have to retain continuity from the model ship, because when it was actually blown up, not trying to give anything away, but it was done as a model miniature with pyrocharges. So that was an element that we had to match pretty closely to for continuity reasons. So obviously the actual look of the thing, it's a big kind of exoskeleton covered in doped fabric. So what we did is we actually took a measurement of the reflectance properties of that fabric. Using a little kind of in-house tool that we've got on to pretty much kind of reflect exactly the same kind of look, so we could intercut pretty seamlessly.
Was that based on the technology used for the bat suit in Batman Begins?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it's exactly the same technology, and it's just matured a little bit now, so that you know, we can push a whole different range of material through it and capture their reflectance properties.
Well, it sounds like an astonishing array of shots to have got through, and certainly the environments, I think, really anchor the shot, because you know, it really is the sense of the place that is the environments.
Sure.
That you did, and they look magnificent.
Thank you.
So thanks so much for taking time to talk to us.
No problem.
And we really look forward to trying to pick it apart in the cinemas.
Fantastic.
So, 22nd of September, it's release date, and again, thank you so much for talking with us.
No problem.
Well, thanks, Alex. Really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. It really sounds like the folks at Double Native pulled out all the stops to get such a large number of shots done in a short period of time. And, of course, integral to those shots are also the 2D compositing pipeline. And so for part two of our podcast, Mike Seymour is going to be speaking with Jody Johnson. And Johnson was the joint 2D supervisor for the film for Double Negative. So let's go ahead and join that conversation now.
So, Jody, if I can pick up with you on the idea of matching to this three-dimensional, effectively, you know, live capture of the aeroplanes. I mean, you were tasked with having to also match the live action of the close-ups of the actors, of course.
Yeah, I mean, we covered close-ups to fairly wide shots with the gimbal planes. The first problem was actually shooting the gimbal planes and making the movements of the planes match as closely as possible to the previs, because obviously the battles were quite finely laid out story-wise, so a lot of the moves were already predetermined. But to translate them on set into moves using a gimbal unit and a techno crane was quite challenging, and it took us a while to get going on that and get the hang of it, you know, because some of the moves got to be done by the camera, some of the moves got to be done by the gimbal. So kind of deciding what part of the move needs to be done with the gimbal, what part of the move needs to be done with the camera, was quite a difficult process. But once we got the hang of that, and all the operators on set seemed to come up to speed, and it kind of went quite well.
I imagine there were some issues there as well, just in terms of the balance between the realism of what the play might be doing and then just the ability to see the actor act. I mean, you know, you're trying to get the performance.
I mean, most of the most of the acting, was done quite close up. So I think, you know, we kind of realised quite early on that the kind of heightened action, you'd be right in there, focused on the actor and his reactions to what's going on around him, because that's, you know, part of the drama of it. So that was very important. So a lot of it takes place very close on the actors. But, you know, like you say, there was some story points where the planes needed to be wider, and we just used fairly exaggerated, you know, acting in order to really sell those points.
And the presumably the shoot-off area, I mean, it must have needed quite a large green screen cycle, whatever, to allow you to shoot with that amount of flexibility on the Technotron crane and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we had a big sound stage. I think it was, where was it? Shepperton? Yeah, we had a large sound stage at Shepperton. And then we had three sides of the studio covered with green screen. It was about 80 feet tall, the green screen, covering three walls of the studio. And then also we had a green screen on the floor. And that meant that we could have the crane at one side of the studio. And then we could... The gimbal was fairly mobile. So with clever planning, we could move the gimbal to be in the correct position in relationship to the crane. And we could shoot above and from all three or four sides of the plane.
It's a non-trivial exercise to light that much green screen evenly. Was lighting a problem on set?
It was. I mean, we used a lot of space lights to give us... I mean, when you're up in the air, you've got a lot of light anyway. So we had to put a lot of light in the studio. And after testing the Genesis, some of the benefits we found was that... one of the problems in low lighting conditions is you get a lot of noise, but because the Genesis, you know, is good in that area, we were able to use what was essentially available light in the studio to light the green screens. So rather than having to have specific lights on the green screens, we just used the light that was there to light the planes and the actors, and then we found that that was enough in the end.
Did you have any on-set compositing? Because obviously you'd be getting a good feed out of the Genesis that would allow that.
Yeah, we did. I mean, it was particularly valuable early on. We took a couple of Macs down onto set. We had some live feeds off the Genesis. And we could composite some of the planes straight into kind of pre-vis CG backgrounds to make sure the moves that we shot were going to work, because again, it's difficult to translate a complex camera move, which also involves a complex plane move that you've made in pre-vis, into actually shooting it on the day with a handheld crane and a hydraulically driven gimbal. It's difficult to translate that move.
I imagine it might have been quite helpful to not have to reload and worry about film loads, because it sounded like quite an elaborate setup. Were you able to just sort of keep shooting, or did you not? Was that not an issue?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. It wasn't really an issue. Ordinarily, it would. We didn't have to worry too much about stock. You know, we didn't have to wait around while we changed the can. I mean, obviously, they still have to be changed, but you've got a lot more time before you need to do that.
And the files that are coming off the Genesis, I presume you were taking the 444 Panalog files and then converting them back at your office, were you?
Yeah. We rented in a deck at Double Negative, and we got the tapes back. And then based on EDLs, we digitised all the footage at Double Negative. We then converted that data into our own linear colour space that we use here. We also developed some very accurate film lookups based on the gamma response of the Genesis, which were unique to this show and completely invaluable because, you know, it allowed us to work completely digitally and be confident that the final result, it was going to be close to the final result that we need, that we were going to end up with on film.
When you were pushing around during the keys and whatever with the Genesis footage, did you find that it had a lot of latitude? I mean, did you just find it good to work with?
Yeah, I mean, it was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting format, isn't it? Because it's not quite the resolution of film, but it's certainly a quite clean image.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of green screen work, in terms of the actual green screen work we did, it saved us, I mean, I'm loath to put a figure on it, but I would say it probably saved us 25 or 30% in terms of time, just because the green screen pulling was so much cleaner and so much less noise, and it just saved us a lot of time. So if we'd have shot on film, I think it would have been a lot more difficult to turn around so many green screen shots in such a short space of time.
And you really hit on a point there as well, because not only were you dealing with a large number of shots, but as we've heard, you were dealing with a relatively short time frame. So I guess not having to worry about scanning and less worry about, just obviously being able to digitise quickly would have made quite a difference.
I mean, like we talked about, we took their EDLs, we digitised it in, and it allowed us to have more control over that process and make sure the data was available when we needed it, to prioritise certain sequences. We didn't, it's quicker to digitise than it is to scan the stuff. It's all real time. And we took the raw data and we did a technical grade on it all before we started work on it, so that we brought it into line. The data for the grading was entered into our company database, which then meant the compositors could use it in their flow graphs or not. So, that the whole kind of digital system just made life a lot more easy for us, I think.
Now, I've just got one question for you. The pipeline that you were working in, I understood, was an OpenEXR kind of pipeline, and you mentioned a moment ago you're in a linear colour space when you converted. When you got to actually compositing, what was the... You're on shake, I presume. What was the colour space, or were you just mixing in it?
No, we work entirely in linear colour space.
And
gamma corrected.
And the compositors had quite a bit of interesting work to do, didn't they? Because there was multi-pass rendering going on from 3D that allowed you to really polish the shots during the composite.
Yeah, I mean, one of the important things was that all the planes were consistent throughout the whole film. Now, if you give 40 compositors 8 CG passes each and tell them to comp them together, they'll all look different. So what we needed to do was have continuity, but also allow the compositors the flexibility to adjust shadows or reflections if that was required, if it was needed. So some of our R&D team wrote a plugin for Shake, which we call Multipass, which basically took all the passes from 3D, did exactly the same maths that are done in RenderMan in Shake, so combined all the passes and gave you a result which was the same as the 3D artist had been lighting to. But then also, on top of that, within the node, they could enhance the shadows, use reflection occlusions, ambient occlusions, when called upon, just to tweak them slightly, for specific shots or lighting conditions or whatever it was on the day. But on the whole, we always started, or not on the whole, on the entirety, we always started with what the 3D artist had produced, because, their lighting, they've got lighting setups across the environments which are going to produce consistent results. So that's what we always started with.
Now, I mean, that obviously is a really helpful pipeline. But tell me, how did that work with the Zeppelin? And can you walk us through some of the issues about integrating the model Zeppelin, the explosion, the live action, and of course, the CG planes?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the challenges, if we deal with the gimbal planes first, you know, was to give them the same feel, to give their movement and lighting the same feel as the CG environments and the CG planes, and as the original previs and battles had been laid out. So, you know, we added a lot of post-camera moves. We added a lot of IMU data, which is the, you know, the real plane data, to the green screen elements. We added a lot of environment, generic environment passes, what we called wispies and woofers, which is, you know, just like faint bits of atmosphere or small clouds passing very close to camera to give a kind of a dynamic and a sense of travel. You know, we also added bullet hits. So that was quite challenging to get the green screens to integrate into this dynamic environment.
Because it's very dramatic, that ends that Zeppelin sequence with the explosion and the and that was a model, wasn't it? A miniature, sorry.
Yeah, that was a miniature. I think it was with Pete Chang shot that in LA. That was a big green screen, a 360 green screen studio they built out there. And I think it was a 30-foot model. Yeah, it was a pretty big model anyway. In fact, I think it was quite a bit bigger than that. It was more like 80, I think. So let's just say it was an 80-foot model. And, you know, that had to be composited into our environment and matched in with 3D planes in the same shots. The 3D planes had to reflect the interactive lighting that coming from the exploding Zeppelin, and again, all our CG Zeppelins, which were used throughout the sequence outside of the explosions, had to have a similar or the same look as our green screen Zeppelins. I know that we did a lot of research early on to get a historically correct look for the Zeppelin. We then gave that to the model makers, so they based the look and design of their model on the Zeppelin which we built, which was based on historically correct information. So once we got the green screens back, we then just had to tweak the look of our Zeppelins a small amount just to match them in exactly. And then we used the same kind of tricks in 2D to integrate all the bits and pieces together. So it was keeping it dynamic, adding moving atmosphere, travelling clouds, lighting tricks to bring it alive and make everything look like it was shot outside, camera shake, to kind of, and all those elements had to follow the pace of the scene. So in the very dramatic areas of the scene, we ramped up the intensity of all the effects we were using, and then in order to provide contrast in the drama, we then ramped them down into the slower areas and then back up again, you know, at the crescendo of the sequences.
This wasn't actually your first period war thing. You worked on Enemy at the Gate, right, a few years ago?
Correct, yeah.
So it must seem like a world of difference to you from what you could pull off on that film versus what you could pull off on this, because this film dwarfs that in terms of, you know, literal production throughput.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the number of shots, certainly, you know, Fireboys, I think, was around 50 minutes of CG. But not to belittle Enemy at the Gates, because I think...
No, I think Enemy...
Some of the work that was done on that film was pretty outstanding and still holds up today as being pretty amazing work.
Actually, you know, that's why...
The Volga crossing at the beginning.
Oh, yeah, no, that's why I mentioned it. In fact, I loved that film and thought it was really, really good. But I couldn't help but, you know, think that it must have been a bit of a contrast for you just in terms of the volume of shots and the capacity for dealing with that volume of work.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the shows were done at a different time for Double Negative, and they were approached in a slightly different way. I think Enemy at the Gates relied upon a very experienced team more to produce the very high level of detail and realism, whereas Flyboys, just because of the sheer number of shots, we had to have a much more pipelined approach, a much more, factory approach to the whole thing. Although you probably shouldn't quote me on that.
No. I know what you mean, though. You're not referring to the quality of the work. You're just simply referring to the fact that you need to be incredibly well organized and have production pipeline stuff in place to be able to act at that professional level and produce that volume of work at the standard that you guys have been doing. I know exactly what you mean.
I mean, you know, and for me, that was a very worthwhile exercise, not only in terms of the final result of the work, but on a personal level it taught me a lot, and I enjoyed, you know, working out those systems. It was a challenge, it was good fun, and I think it moved us on as a company as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing that's really fascinating about Double Negative, is that you really see this progression of tools. We've been lucky enough to talk to you guys on a couple of projects, and you can see stuff that started in one film with smoke in Batman Begins that gets built and worked on with, say...
Trade Center.
Yeah, exactly. And then it just... presumably you're using the same kind of techniques, although expanded in the aerial, you know, burning fire, shooting up stuff of...
Yeah.
Of Flyboys, and it is, it's the IP of the company, isn't it? It's the skills to be able to pull that together, and you guys have an outstanding set of your own proprietary tools now that complement the other ones that you have from outside.
I mean, Double Negative have grown a lot in the last 3 years, and that's allowed us to employ a consistent R&D team who've developed and maintained these tools. And, you know, each film, because the tools are proprietary, it means they can be tailored to the exact needs of each film, because each film needs something slightly different. And if you use off-the-shelf software, you don't have the flexibility that we have with the proprietary software, because I can just ring up the guys who write it and tell them exactly what I need, and we can spend time developing that.
And yet,
that's why those tools are more effective for us.
And yet you've got to balance that, of course, with the fact that you still need to have things like shake and stuff in there, because otherwise it's hard to get operators and ramp up the people. So it's a balance, isn't it, really, between where to use your R&D expertise and where to have tools that allow you to get access to good artists at short notice on the freelance market.
I mean, I suppose Meyer and Shake are like a skeleton framework that our pipelines are based on, or a central core, and all the rest of the proprietary stuff sits around that, and, you know, and uses those two pieces of software as a hub, really.
Yeah, the Mel scripting and the scripting nature of Shake lend themselves so well to integrating into that kind of proprietary pipeline.
I mean, we wrote all sorts of plugins for Flyboys. We talked about the multi-pass. We wrote specific lens flare plugins that were based on Genesis lens flares that we shot. We wrote plugins that would do specific types of camera shake. We wrote a plugin called Confusion that does depth-based defocusing based on real-life camera information. And all those plugins sit within Shake and are there to access like any other node, you know. And they were all designed most of those nodes were designed or could be tweaked to work specifically within the remit of Flyboys.
We should give
be able to focus those tools.
You should give a shout out to the R&D team. Who heads up the R&D team that does those Shake plugins? Because
in terms of the Shake plugins, the two main protagonists are Chris Byrne, who is our head of 2D. Now, he's a very important person within Double Negative because you're talking about the continuity and the proprietary software across all projects, and his job is to sit and look across all projects and make sure that the demands that each project is taking advantage of the tool set that Double Negative has, you know. So he's a kind of, he oversees all the tool sets and makes sure everyone's got what they need and is aware of what they can use. So that's Chris Byrne. He also wrote a lot of the stuff for Flyboys. And then also we've got Ted Wayne, who heads up the R&D side of our 2D work. He also writes a lot of, has written a lot of standalone software for us. We've got a proprietary rotoscoping software. We've got proprietary editing software that he writes. So he's an important person in that side of things.
Well, look, thank you so much for taking time out to talk to us. And congratulations on the film.
Thanks very much.
And hopefully you'll get some rest now you've delivered and the film opens.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Speak to you soon. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.